Thank you, Lee. I just long to get in the discussion myself, but I know I'm not allowed to, so. Our next speaker is Warren Nutter, who must be known to most of you. I owe it to the Mont Pelerin Society for knowing Warren over a good many years, and that's the second thing I owe to Professor Hayek. One was the idea of the IEA in London. The other was the Mont Pelerin Society, at which I first met the speaker but next but one, Arthur, on my right. Now, Warren Nutter is presently at the University of Virginia. He says he has been, I suspect he still is, an expert on Russian affairs, Eastern economics. He has worked in the government in Washington, and as I say, he and I have met frequently at Mont Pelerin Society meetings. Now, Warren, will you please address us?
Let's hope that the Mont Pelerin Society survives. There's a certain poignancy about meeting on this subject and discussing this subject in the domain of the Big Apple, which is tottering on the brink of something or other at this point in time. But this is an odd society in many ways. It's built up certain traditions. One tradition is that it always ends its programs on an upbeat. The second is that no matter what happens on the outside world, in the outside world, the questions before this society never change, nor do the answers. And the third tradition is that we always look at these issues from different perspectives. Now, mine, I suppose, is intended to be the academic, and academia, as you all know, is the place where knowledge accumulates, and you know how it accumulates. The freshmen, or should we say fresh persons, bring a little bit in with them, and the seniors don't take any away. And so it accumulates. What is an academician's response to this question? Will capitalism survive? Well, the first way he might answer the question is a typical one by asking another question, and I suppose that would be till when. The second would be to take recourse in Stigler's law, which you all know. Stigler's law is, I don't know whether this is first or second, that every title posed in the form of a question has the answer no. The third is by recourse to Schumpeter's optimistic prognosis. If I might give a very brief quote, which comes in a very handy little document from Hillsdale College, if I might give an ad to them, Don. In fact, it's called Will Capitalism Survive? I don't know if this was published in 1909 or when, but here's the quote from Schumpeter. Can capitalism survive? No, I do not think it can. The thesis I shall endeavor to establish is that the actual and prospective performance of the capitalist system is such as to negative the idea of its breaking down under the weight of economic failure, but that its very success undermines the social institutions which protect it and inevitably creates conditions in which it will not be able to live and which strongly point to socialism as the heir apparent. I'm very sorry to report to you that over the years, the more I have reflected on Schumpeter's writings and the more I've reread them, the more I have found them to be, unfortunately, very accurate in their predictions. And as you recall, his main emphasis was on the intellectuals, that leisurely class that's created by capitalism. The intellectuals are destroying the system. As so many others have noted, including Schumpeter, it seems to be in the nature of the intellectual to be arrogantly romantic, to end up being a professional social critic of any society in which he may have the good fortune to be allowed to survive that doesn't permit him to run the society. And those who may live under the illusion that somehow political movements in this country are going in a different direction and reducing the influence of intellectuals are, I'm afraid, bound to be disappointed. Just reflect on our current government and on the government under, in particular, under President Nixon. The three top cabinet members, and up till recently the two top ones, were outstanding members of the Eastern intellectual establishment. Messrs. Kissinger, Schlesinger, and Schultz. They all went to school within a few miles of each other. And whatever else they might have professed about conservatism and preserving the American system and all that, their ideology fundamentally was one of authoritarian romanticism, if I may coin a term. This is particularly true of the gentleman who's still our Secretary of State. And let me just, in the way of a few discursive remarks that I'm giving you, and I'm going to remark until my time runs out, is what it boils down to. Let me read you a couple of things from Kissinger's writings, very brief, to indicate the kind of philosophy that dominates in our government today, and should give you pause. I read these quotes in order to take advantage of advertising this very outstanding book, which is just out. First quotation. The statesman is therefore like one of the heroes in classical drama who has had a vision of the future but who cannot validate its truth. Nations learn only by experience. They know only when it is too late to act. But statesmen must act as if their intuition were already experience, as if their aspiration were truth. It is for this reason that statesmen often share the fate of prophets, that they are without honor in their own country, that they always have a difficult task in legitimizing their programs domestically, and that their greatness is usually apparent only in retrospect when their intuition has become experience. Let me continue with a second quotation which may shed some light on what he seems to mean by these profound remarks. The issue may therefore turn on a philosophical problem described earlier. The overemphasis on realism and the definition of reality as being entirely outside the observer may produce a certain passivity and a tendency to adapt to circumstance rather than to master it. It may also produce a gross underestimation of the ability to change, indeed, to create reality. To recapture the ability and the willingness to build our own reality is perhaps our ultimate challenge. Now, the only moral that I wish to leave with you from these very brief quotations is that there is a climate of opinion among our leadership that is not exactly congenial to the philosophy of capitalism or of democratic type of order, which is normally associated with capitalism. Well, so lead the intellectuals, and I'm sorry to say, the public gaily follows. And to illustrate, let me trace the trend of what's happened to the welfare state in 14 Western countries. You would be very disappointed if an economist didn't give you some numbers. And whenever an economist is in doubt, he always quotes statistics, so I'm going to give you some numbers. Now, these 14 countries are the ones normally associated with OECD. I don't know that I need it. It's Australia, Austria, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, West Germany, Japan, Italy, Netherlands, Norway, the UK, and the United States. And I've summarized a few figures. Those of you who have been up in the front have seen them. You don't know what they are, and you won't know now. Now, I don't know whether you can read this or not, and it may not matter, because I will try to explain. What I have here are some summaries of what has been happening to government spending as a percentage of national income in these 14 countries. And the first half of the board has to do with the total spending of government, and the second with the domestic spending, leaving out the defense and foreign affairs and all of that. In other words, the domestic type programs over here. Now, what are the figures? This is a frequency distribution in the early 50s, the early 60s, the early 70s of those percentages. The countries in which the percentage was between 0 and 10 in all years is 0. And you see one country shows up as in the group 10 to 20%. In all three periods, it's the same country. Try to figure out which one it is. And then you see the other distribution. In the early 50s, the about half of the countries had less than 30%, and half had more. The lowest percentage was 16. The highest was 41. The United States was in the lower half, 28%. We were very good country. The lowest figure, as we go through the 60s and the 70s, has remained around 16%, the same country. But if you'll notice, the median has gone up first from 30 to 39%, now to 49% in the early 70s. We're in the mid-70s, this is the early 70s. So it's above that now. The range in the early 70s was from 17 to 60%. The United States was 39%. We're still in the lower half. Now, let me read you what's happened in terms of the countries themselves in this shift. The other figures are really take out essentially the defense spending and show the picture in terms of the domestic economy, what domestic spending by government is as a fraction of national income. I won't elaborate on those. You've already got too many numbers. If you wanted a sort of median country that would fit the pattern of what's happened, it would be Canada. Canada is half or better, half or worse. The bottom country I'm going to leave for surprise to the end. The big change has been at the top. If we start in the early 50s, the four leaders, the four biggest governments, were Italy, West Germany, the UK, and France, the old-timers. One might have predicted that. If you look at domestic spending alone, then there's a switch. The UK goes out and Austria comes in. In the 70s, the four leaders are an entirely different group. Denmark, Netherlands, Sweden, and Norway. And their percentages run from 52 to 60 as the government spending as a percentage of national income. Now, the country at the bottom, as you probably have guessed, is Japan. And Japan has stayed rather steadily at the bottom with about the same size of government. I think there's a great mistake in the West in attributing Japanese success to the fact they don't have any military force. I think the success is much more attributable to this fact, that the government is small. Now, there's only one other Western country whose government is equally small, for which I can get figures, and that's South Africa. All right. If we were to look, and I'm not going to give you the numbers because you've got enough, but if we were to look just at transfer payments, what's happened to those, taking money out of one set of pockets and giving it to the other? In the early 50s, for these same countries, the range of transfer payments as a percentage of national income was from 3 to 16%. The median was about 8. The United States, it was 5. So we were again below the median. In the 70s, in the early 70s, the range was 5 to 24%, and the median 17%. The median percentage had doubled in this 20 years. In the United States, our percentage rose from 5 to 10. It also doubled. But still, we're in the backwaters of this movement. I think we're moving rapidly to catch up, but we're still, what we're doing is tracing the path that's been followed in so many different places. Now, I've argued elsewhere, and I'm not going to repeat it here, that, in my opinion, the evidence seems to indicate that the bigger democratic, we can use that term loosely, democratic governments become the weaker they become, the less stable they become, the closer the elections become, the less authority the government in power can wield, and hence the more attentive the elected official becomes to public opinion in the immediate, that is, in the polls, and always looking over his shoulder and hoping that the 1% differential will go in his favor. I think this is clearly the case in Britain. It's the case in Germany. It's the case in the Lowlands. It was the case in France in the last election. It also leads, of course, to fractioning of parties, the building up of the small faction with tremendous power as the swing vote, and so on. And I think this is the most disturbing factor, that, in fact, capitalism is devouring itself politically in the sense that government is being undermined, and all the rest of the aspects of society, largely the question of the size of government is important, and the reason being that there's always the question of who's going to benefit at the expense of whom. And the voters have no problem when the size of government is 15%. Well, you can soak the rich, or at least there's some minority that can be soaked to help the majority. But when that fraction gets up to 60%, well, who's being taken away from in order to benefit whom? I mean, the best that any system can do is to set up a situation in which just slightly less than half of the public exploits the other half. I am in hopes that things will not move to a point that was described in this way in an earlier time. Let me read you a quotation you might like to have in your billfold. "And thus the frame of democracy was dissolved and gave place to the rule of violence and force. For when once the people are accustomed to be fed without any cost or labor, and to derive all the means of their subsistence from the wealth of other citizens, if at this time some bold and enterprising leader should arise, whose poverty has shut him out from all the honors of the state, then commences the government of the multitude, who run together in tumultuous assemblies and are hurried into every kind of violence, assassinations, banishments, and divisions of lands, till, being reduced at last to a state of savage anarchy, they once more find a master and a monarch and submit themselves to arbitrary sway." I read this quotation only to show Tony I can outdo him. This comes from Polybius, a Greek historian of the 2nd century B.C. I hope we will not reach this point. So far as I can see, the only real possibility that we won't is some kind of remarkable renaissance or almost revolution in our thinking. And as one of my old professors used to say a number of years ago, when the problem was already apparent, in fact, it was 35 years ago, we're probably all going to hell, but at least we can yell on the way and scream. And I think that's the best we can do. Thank you.